He stepped out of line.
Hey, where you going?
The man with burns said. I'm going home, said Pete. Chapter 89. Miracles over easy. The small cafe was filled with people. Young men wearing military uniforms accompanied by young women were sitting side by side in booths, leaning close. Old men sat on stools reading newspapers. A single waitress wearing a white apron bobbed and weaved through the narrow walkways between tables. The quiet chatter of the morning bustle was coupled with the sound of crackling bacon on a flat stove. Dim lights hung over the bar where Ruth sat. She was positioned between men who wore denim, smoked morning cigarettes, and wore the lined faces of those who were poor. They spoke among themselves in voices that were low-pitched and dry. She ate her eggs and toast, and listened to them talk about their children and their wives, using 3 and 4 words at a time. Men like them were not kind to lay their feelings out in the open, but they did not hide them either.
You going to the revival?
Said one man.
Hell no. You? Don't know. Me neither. Well, I sure as shoeshine don't want to go, but my wife's threatened to divorce me if I don't. Oh, she's only trying to save your soul, Ben. Don't you need saving, Ben?
All the men laughed.
I don't need saving. I'm Catholic.
He made the sign of the cross. This drew more laughter from those nearby. Even those who were eavesdropping, like Ruth, laughed to themselves.
Well, Catholics don't all go to heaven, said one man. My mother-in-law's Catholic, and she's a flat-out devil worshiper.
Yeah, well, this Catholic's going, said Ben. My daddy paid good money to get us in.
Oh, it doesn't work that way, Ben. Yeah, maybe not for Baptist, but it does when you're Catholic.
Another man added.
I don't know about that, but I can say after 6 years of Catholic school, if you're late to chapel, those nuns will slit your throat with a pencil sharpener.
Yeah, well, another man said. My wife's going to the J. Wilbur thing, too. He's dragging all our youngins, tried to tell her it was a bunch of hokum, but she's got her own ideas.
The young man leaned into the conversation.
Yeah, well, J. Wilbur ain't all that bad. Actually, I think he's a good man.
The men slapped their knees when they heard this.
That man's a phony if ever there was one, said Ben. Mercy, I'm so glad to be Catholic.
Yeah, well, I like him,
said the young man.
They say signs and wonders follow everywhere he goes. I heard a man in Iowa sprouted a new leg at one of J. Wilbur's revivals.
A new leg, said Ben. Where'd he end up putting it?
Another man interjected.
Does that mean you're going to see him, Eddie? Tell us the truth. Have you already bought your tickets to see J. Wilbur?
I don't need no tickets. Says on the radio it's free.
An elderly man wiped his face and threw his napkin on the counter.
I swear, you idiots believe anything these days. You're the reason the world's in such a mess.
Yeah,
said another older man.
What's happening to the world? I can't even read the papers no more. Hogwash on every page. They claim somebody raised somebody from the dead over in Washington County.
Bunch of horse flop. Ben scoffed.
Newspapers do anything to get a nickel.
It's all bull. It's all bull.
You can say that again.
I just did.
Hear, hear.
I don't know if it's bull or not, said the young man.
My brother heard it was true about that man being raised from the dead.
There was a long pause.
Hand of God, said the young man. My brother said the fellow was as dead as a roofing tack. Then a bright light come out of the sky and...
Another pause.
And what?
Said the old man.
It made him sprout a new leg? No. My brother says the man sat upright and started doing all sorts of backflips and speaking in foreign tongues and people was getting saved all over the place and there was a brass band...
Backflips? Brass band?
You're full of it, said one man.
That ain't what the paper said. Said it was a woman who did it, not a light from the sky. And I didn't read nothing about no backflips.
A whore's what I heard.
Get out of here!
Yeah, a whore raising the dead. That's what they said. It was right there in the paper.
You full of dew.
I'm as serious as I can be. Read the paper.
Well... said one man, tossing his money on the counter. I don't read papers, no how. They print anything, even if it is horse flop.
Ruth watched them walk out of the restaurant. She saw them crawl into old vehicles and leave the parking lot. They reminded her of Paul and Vern and the people she missed. When she paid for her meal at the cash register, the cashier was reading a newspaper. The photograph on the front was of a man standing behind a pulpit. The man's face was lean and his jaw was square. The picture showed him leaning over the pulpit toward an audience, shaking his fist at them.
Who's that on the front page?
She asked the man who was holding the paper.
Well, depends on who you ask, the man said. Some folks think he's Jesus Christ. What about you? What do you think?
Don't ask me. I was born Catholic.
Chapter 90. The Persuader.
This is a stupid idea, said Joseph, who was eating from a can of pork and beans. If you got a better idea, I'm all ears. Joseph sighed. I don't see why we can't leave town like the lucky crooks that we are. No, I gotta do something. Coot wheeled the truck into the train depot fast enough to kick up a cloud of dust. The place was almost vacant. Coot had expected to see a crowd of people, but there was nobody. Coot, this is grasping at straws. You can't do nothing but a bunch of religious nuts on the courthouse steps. You're just one man. Those men wanted to kill her. But they didn't, see? God provides. She needs our help. Sometimes you have to know when to give up, kid. This is one of them times. Well, then give up. You want to tuck tail? Fine. I'm not. Not until she's safe. J. Wilbur Chaplin's rail car was plain-looking, dark green with faded paint. Coot had expected something fancier. The car sat on the tracks just behind the painted field. It was so calm, it made Coot feel jumpy.
This place is empty, Coot said. I wonder where everyone is.
Beats me. Probably on the courthouse steps roasting weenies and reading the book of Revelation.
The windows of the rail car glowed orange in the night. The shades were drawn, but Coot could see the shadows of figures in the car moving from side to side. Coot watched a man open the back door to the caboose. The man lit a cigar. Coot saw the ember glow in the dark.
You stay here if you want. I'm going to go.
Go do something.
Go do what? Said Joseph with a mouth full of beans.
I don't know. I improvise. If all else fails, I'll start crying.
Crying? Have you lost your marbles? What kind of man are you?
I ain't really going to cry. Just fake cry.
That's your big idea? You come all the way out here into the middle of nowhere just to work up some phony tears? You're out of your mind.
Well, what do you suggest?
Joseph said nothing.
He only shrugged and shoveled more food into his mouth.
I can't believe you're eating at a time like this. I thought we agreed you'd never eat beans again after last time.
So shoot me. I've been hungry since I come back from the afterlife. All I can think about is food. They had us on government rations back there in that hick jail. All I was going to waste away.
Coot leaned his forehead against the window. He was deep in thought, with only the sound of an old man chewing with his mouth open and making little grunts of ecstasy. Coot watched the man on the back porch of the caboose. The man tossed his cigar into the night, then walked back inside.
Coot said, how am I going to do this? Think.
Joseph smacked the glove box. He removed a pistol and tossed it into Coot's lap.
What's this? What's it look like? Old Roscoe the Persuader. That's what it is. Are you nuts? This ain't about me. I'm not walking in there with a gun.
Suit yourself, but you don't have a chance any other way.
Coot placed the gun on the dashboard.
Don't be ridiculous. They'd shoot me.
No, they won't. They're Christians.
So they'd shoot me twice.
Ah, where's your sporting blood, son?
You're nuts.
Joseph lifted the gun, spun the cylinder, then clicked it shut.
You pop in there holding Roscoe and say to that preacher man, come with daddy, sucker, and he'll do it. Simple as that.
Put that thing away before you hurt somebody. Hadn't you had enough bullets to last one lifetime?
And that's exactly how you'd want to say it, too, real forceful-like. Come with daddy, sucker.
Pretty good, huh?
Joseph was clearly impressed with himself.
I'm only thinking of your girlfriend, Coot. That man ain't gonna give you a second look unless you got something worth looking at, like Roscoe.
Give me that gun, said Coot.
Joseph handed Coot the gun.
That's more like it.
Coot opened the cylinder and emptied the bullets into his hand. Then he rolled down his window and tossed them into the darkness.
You dunce! That's all the ammo I had!
He gave the gun back to Joseph. No more guns. Coot leapt out of the car. Joseph waited in the truck. Coot crept through the rail yard, rehearsing what he would say. Maybe Joseph was right. Maybe J. Wilbur Chaplin wouldn't hear a word he had to say. Maybe this was a wasted effort. Coot climbed the steps onto the rail car and took a few breaths before he rapped on the glass panel of the door. He cupped his hand over his mouth and smelled his own breath. He took a few steps back and waited. The bald man opened the door and gave Coot a serious look. He stood in the doorway like a human tank. The neck on this man was nearly as big as Coot's upper thigh.
Can I help you, son? The man said.
Coot cleared his throat.
Yes, I'm with the,
The man raised his eyebrows.
I'm sorry, son. He don't receive visitors.
The man placed a meaty hand on the knob and shut the door. Coot pressed his boot between the door and the jamb. The door closed on his foot, and he thought he might have felt a few bones break. I know he doesn't want no visitors, but this is an emergency.
Emergency, said the bald man.
It's life and death.
Life and death? Write him a letter. You know how many people got life and death emergencies for Jay Wilbur?
He pressed the door closed. This time, Coot wedged his torso through the door and said, There's no time for letters. I need 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes, please. The man placed his Virginia ham-sized hand on Coot's throat and shoved him from the doorway. He followed Coot outside and shut the door behind him. He gave Coot a smirk.
You're crazy, kid. Now get out of here before I teach you how to turn the other cheek.
He went back inside and closed the door.
Please, please, 5 minutes.
Coot slammed his fists against the door and beat out a steady rhythm.
Please, please.
Coot pretended to sob.
I'm begging you. I'm begging you.
The man opened the door again. He pressed Coot backward using his fist. He stared at Coot with a face that seemed more sympathetic than Coot expected. The man drew in a long, annoyed breath.
Wait right here, he said.
Fake crying, Coot thought to himself. Works every time. Chapter 91. Jay Wilbur. The interior of J. Wilbur Chaplin's rail car was plain. There were no decorations, no intricate woodwork, and no chandeliers. There were only two beds, a kitchenette, and a fan in the corner, blowing. Coot had only heard stories about him as a child, and he expected the man to be the poster boy for gracious living. But this man was traveling in a rail car that needed a fresh coat of paint and a few throw pillows. He was only a few notches above Coot's jail cell. He stood before the man, remembering all the things he'd heard about him. He heard all the stories there were. This man, many claimed, had changed tent preaching forever. Until J. Wilbur's time, men had been preachers who begged sinners to come down the aisle using big words and high English. But J. Wilbur came into town and spoke common words, the people's language. Sometimes he even used words that made sailors gasp, or so the stories went. Long ago, Blake told Coot that J. Wilbur once waved his hand over an entire auditorium and the whole place broke into spontaneous weeping for 91 minutes. People went crazy and started tearing their shirts and hiding beneath pews, praying for the wrath of God to spare them. And legend had it that J. Wilbur stood on a piano, wearing only his underpants, and preached for 2 hours. But here, standing before the man, Coot couldn't help but doubt the facts within these stories. This man seemed quiet and reserved. He was nothing at all like the voice on the tinny radio speakers, and he didn't seem like a legend. All at once, Coot felt ashamed to be here.
I read about this woman in the paper, said J. Wilbur. The papers were not kind to her. They were using some coarse descriptions.
So you've heard of her, said Coot.
Oh, you'd have to be hiding under a rock not to hear about this woman they call the harlot.
J. Wilbur invited Coot to sit on the chair across from him while he ate a late supper. Coot told the man about what had happened. He told him everything, starting from the beginning, about how she brought Joseph back with just a touch. Coot was surprised to see how kind J. Wilbur was. He did not seem like a man who would stand on a piano wearing only his underpants. He looked like anyone else. At times he was humorous, light-hearted, and he was calm. He was, in fact, one of the nicest men Coot had ever met. And this disappointed Coot. He wanted to hate this man for all he represented, for the world he came from. But there was nothing to hate. Finally, when Coot had run out of words, J. Wilbur went to his cabinet and removed a can. He held it toward Coot.
Would you like some Ovaltine?
J. Wilbur shook the can for effect.
Ovaltine?
Said Coot.
Yes, sir. Ovaltine contains malt, milk, eggs, fortified with necessary vitamins and minerals. And it's America's food beverage, assisting in maintaining and building up health and strength and energy and encouraging health-restorative sleep to keep your body and mind feeling strong and vigorous.
Why not? J. Wilbur opened the can, stabbed a spoon into it, then mixed the brownish powder with the milk. I never go anywhere without my Ovaltine. There's nothing like it. He fixed Coot a glass, too. Maybe he was the kind of man who preached for 2 hours in his underpants. Finally, J. Wilbur said, "You saw all this yourself, son. You saw her bring this man back to life." When he said it, he gave Coot the first hint of a look that resembled a preacher's stare. Then he took a sip of Ovaltine and left a chocolate-colored milk mustache on his upper lip. "Yeah, I was holding him when it happened," said Coot. "And what was it like?" "Well, his body went from being stiff and hard and cold to being warm and moving. But now he's alive again, and, well, he's a different man."
"Different? How?"
"Well, he used to have a problem with the bottle, and he hadn't taken a drink since it happened."
"Astounding," said J. Wilbur, killing his glass. "Absolutely astounding. Would you like some more Ovaltine?"
"No, I'm still working on it." J. Wilbur fixed another glass. He approached Coot and started to say something, but removed his eyeglasses and placed the stem in his mouth, holding a far-off but dignified look on his face. Coot wished he wore eyeglasses so he could do this.
"Son, you know, I've seen a lot of things in the heat of the moment. A lot of things. Once I saw a man bark like a Labrador in Pittsburgh."
Coot said, "Now, I've seen crazy people before. I've seen bogus healings, more than I'd like to remember. This isn't that. This is the real thing." J. Wilbur turned his glass of Ovaltine upside down and drained the whole thing in a few gulps. He wiped his mouth with his shirt sleeve and said,
"These are exciting times, ain't they, son?"
A spark filled the man's eye, and the roundness of his face faded. His age momentarily disappeared.
"These are exciting times," he clapped once. "What do you say your name was?"
Coot felt his thighs drop into his bowels. He'd gone the entire conversation without referring to E.P., and he didn't want to start now.
"My name? It doesn't matter."
"Of course it matters. A young man comes to me speaking of the dead, breathing anew, inheriting revitalized bodies. This young man has to have a name."
"My name's Coot." J. Wilbur frowned.
"Coot? What an interesting name. Is it a nickname?"
"Yes, sir. It's short for Thurston Reginald McMillan III.
"Really?"
"No, it's just plain old Coot. I believe you knew my father." Coot paused. The words felt heavy coming out of his mouth. He'd never said those words before. Not like that. Not in his entire life had he ever used the word father in relation to E.P. In fact, he'd never called anyone father, not even the Almighty.
"Who was your daddy?"
said J. Wilbur, smiling. Coot swallowed a sip of Ovaltine. It was too late to turn back now.
"E.P. Willard, sir."
J. Wilbur let out a single laugh. He slapped his knee and leaned forward to look into Coot's face. He seemed to be studying Coot.
"Well, I'll be dog," the man said. "I thought you looked familiar. Why, you look just like him, boy. Eddie Willard, your father, the Eddie Willard."
"The one and only."
"Well, how is your pa? Why, I haven't seen him in a coon's age, son."
"Yeah, he's good. He's been tied up lately."
"Oh, that's marvelous. I'm glad to hear it."
They were interrupted by a crash of glass. The door to the rail car was shattered by a rock that landed in the center of the rail car floor. Then a loud crash. Then the door flung open and slammed against the wall. In the doorway stood Joseph, bearing a pistol and flinty eyes that suggested he was not there to play patty cake.
"All right, preacher man," Joseph said. "Come with Daddy, sucker."
Chapter 92, Joy to the World. Pete was lying in bed, watching the ceiling fan spin in lazy circles. He'd never actually seen a ceiling fan before staying in this motel. They were strange devices, but they worked so well. The gentle breeze fell upon him and did little to keep him cool, but it felt good nonetheless. This only led him to wonder what air conditioning was like. He'd only ever seen one air conditioner in his life. He'd heard if you breathed the air from an air conditioner too long, you would develop asthma or, in some extreme cases, go blind. He wasn't sure if it was true, but he was very careful when he went into places that had air conditioning and did his best to hold his breath. Ruth was asleep beside him. String Bean was lying on Ruth's feet, curled into a ball. He wanted more than anything to leave this town and go back home. He wanted to find a small house and start a small farm, maybe raise cotton or tobacco and, God willing, hunting dogs. But he knew that Ruth was feeling different things in this city, and he did not want to disappoint her. She was everything to him. Ruth rolled under her side. Pete could see her violet eyes boring into him. She was no longer asleep.
"What are you thinking?"
she asked. "I'm thinking that I love this ceiling fan.
Maybe we can get one someday."
"Maybe." She touched his face. She brought herself closer to him and spoke in a hushed voice.
"I feel something here,"
she said.
I don't know.
"What?"
"I feel like I should be here. Like there's something here."
He didn't want to tell her that he felt the exact opposite. He didn't want to ruin her excitement. She was a girl who had adventure in her. He knew this. He was a man who could stay in one place so long he developed moss on his backside. "You like it here?"
"No."
This confused him. He sat straight up in bed. "You don't," he said, and String Bean moaned. She did not like to be disturbed while in the throes of sleep.
"No. It's too big for me."
He felt elation. "So you don't like it here?"
"No, but I feel something here."
"You feel what?"
"Something."
Ruth was hard to understand.
"I mean, it's like I'm supposed to be here for something. Something big. It's a feeling in my stomach."
Pete nodded. "Well, it's hard to find work here." By hard, he meant he had a better chance of becoming president of the United States than finding a job bagging groceries.
I know it is.
She wrapped her arms around him.
"I don't know what it is about this place, though. I don't know why I feel this way."
"Well, it's part of your history, I guess. I mean, you were born not far from here."
"Yeah, but it's deeper than that. You know how it is after Thanksgiving?"
"Thanksgiving?"
"Yeah, you know how everything feels when Christmas is on its way?"
"I don't follow you." Rarely did he ever.
"Come on, you know how even though nothing is different about the world, the weather's sort of the same, it feels like a totally different place to live, like there's something magic in the air?"
"Are we really having a conversation about the magic of Christmas right now?"
"No," she swatted his shoulder. "Listen to me, will you? I feel that same sort of happy feeling I get in December, but not in the same sort of way."
"Well, I'll be sure to pick up some garland on the way home tomorrow." She laughed.
"I mean it. I really do. Don't you feel anything?"
"Do I feel anything?"
"Yeah, don't you feel something?"
He kissed her forehead. He wanted to tell her that he felt homesick. He wanted to admit that he missed home so bad he could taste it. He wanted to tell her that he felt alone in this godforsaken city without a friend in the world except a spoiled bloodhound. He wanted her to know how bad he missed his bunk on Miss Warner's farm and waking up to train his dogs to follow trails. He wanted to, but he couldn't. His life half belonged to her now, and her happiness half belonged to him. And even though he was dreaming home, he would not tarnish her newfound happiness. "I miss Vern," he said.
"Me too."
"And I miss Paul."
"Oh, so do I."
"I do not miss Miss Warner." She started laughing.
"Not even just a little bit?"
"Maybe a little."
"I know you miss home. I miss it too. But I'm glad to be here with you."
"I don't miss it that much," he lied. She closed her eyes and fell asleep on his chest. She seemed to be wearing a gentle smile. He twirled a strand of her hair in his hand while watching the hypnotic ceiling fan above him.
"Good night,"
she whispered. "Merry Christmas," he said. Chapter 93. Ride with the Lord. Coot, Joseph, and J. Wilbur Chaplin sat in the back seat together. They rode to the early light with the sunrise ahead of them. J. Wilbur wore a white linen suit, a high collar and brass cufflinks. J. Wilbur was a man who had an endearing calmness to him. He seemed perpetually relaxed. Even after Joseph had threatened to gut him like a godless trout, Joseph's exact words, the man was easygoing. Somehow, Coote had managed to get the gun away from Joseph and convince the most famous man in America that they were not lunatics. Not entirely. And in only a few minutes, Chaplin had agreed to help them. They piled into the man's car and shot through the dark until the sun began to rise. The morning scenery passed them at slow speeds. J. Wilbur Chaplin looked out the window. "You know, Coote, I used to be a professional baseball player." Coote was jolted from his thoughts. "A ball player? You?" J. Wilbur almost seemed surprised by Coote's response. "Didn't your father tell you about me?" Coote cringed at the usage of the word father. "Yes, they called me Lulu the Lefty. I was a sidearm." J. Wilbur showed his left hand to Coote. "Oh, I was one doozy of a left-handed pitcher. They offered me $2,000 a year to play in St. Louis. I almost took it, too." J. Wilbur looked out the window. He was light-hearted and easy. Coote respected him for this alone. Coote himself was a passionate man who had a habit of worrying about everything. "Yes, I went to this revival outside Atlanta, in a big tent. I was only there because of a girl I liked. Oh, she wanted to go." J. Wilbur raised his eyebrows. "Oh, I thought she was as hot as an oven mitten. So, I went." Joseph had already fallen asleep beside Coote. He could feel Joseph's heavy breathing on his neck and smell his deadly mule breath. He adjusted Joseph's position so the old man's mouth would be aimed in the opposite direction. "A girl," said Coote. "Yes, I'd never even set foot in a church before, if you can believe it." "Really?" "As I live and breathe, a girl will make you do strange things, son. Make you forget all about what you hold to be common sense. So I've heard." "Oh, I'll never forget it. I saw this young man preaching on the stage, wearing all white. Oh, he was wild and theatrical. Before I knew it, I found myself walking down the aisle for salvation when the music played, almost against my will. That's how good he was." Joseph adjusted himself against Coote. The old man released an aroma that filled the car and caused Coote to roll down the window. "Anyway, when I got to the altar that night, long ago, I saw that this young preacher was about my age." He laughed. "I could hardly believe it. A man my age, making such a difference in the world, commanding an audience for the cause of goodness and charity and Christian kindness. The man prayed for me, and it did something to me. It changed me. He told me his name was E.P. Willard. Oh, beautiful man, your father." The words stung Coote's ears. Are you sure it was him?" "Oh, we were friends for a few years after that. He taught me how to be who I was meant to be." J. Wilbur closed his eyes. "I turned down St. Louis. I was afraid I was going to do the wrong thing. I'd never been so scared in all my life." "And what happened?" "Well, I joined the revival troupe for $16 a week. I changed my name, and that was the end of Lulu the Lefty." "So J. Wilbur isn't your real name?" "No, sorry to say it isn't. All preachers back then were using initials instead of names." "So what's your real name?" "Herman Pickles." The car neared the courthouse. Coote could see the crowds of people gathered like bees around a honeycomb, and he could see a change in J. Wilbur's persona immediately. The man went from being relaxed to assuming the personality E.P. had once used, only this was no act. It was the man he'd heard on the radio. A man who had inspired a country during times of war, pestilence, and famine. The man removed his eyeglasses and handed them to his driver. "Bill," J. Wilbur said to the driver, "pull right up to the lawn of the courthouse. These people want a revival. Let's give them what they want." The car leapt over the curb and jostled Coote and Joseph from side to side. Joseph was startled awake with a snort. He looked around and said, "What's going on here?" "We're here," said Coote.
"Already?"
"Yeah."
"I must have fallen asleep. What'd I miss?"
Coote shushed him, then said, "I ain't never gonna let you eat another pinto bean in your life, old man." The crowd parted and let the car through. The vehicle crept through the makeshift camp before the courthouse and ran over smoldering campfires and edges of tents. People pressed their faces against the windows. Coote could see children trying to get a better look at who was inside. When the car came to a stop, there were people on all sides of the vehicle, standing in herds like cattle. Jay Wilbur straightened his collar and smoothed his hair. He leaned toward Coot. "I owe a lot to your daddy, son," he patted Coot's leg. "In fact, I owe your daddy my eternal salvation, you could say." The dignified man bowed his head briefly. Coot could see that he was praying. Coot bowed his head, too. Then Jay Wilbur kicked open the door and stepped out. The man crawled onto the top of his car like a man half his age. His long legs were limber and his movements were quick. Coot was surprised to see the man move so fast. His shoes made banging noises on the automobile roof. He shouted, he clapped his hands, he stomped his feet until he nearly bent the dome of the car. He removed his coat and rolled up the sleeves of his sweat-stained shirt. He unbuttoned his collar. Coot could see Marigold's face in the open window of the courthouse above, and he could still feel her kiss. Jay Wilbur Chaplin spoke of God and miracles and power and angels and healers. The veins in his head showed. Coot was unable to take his eyes from the man. And when Jay Wilbur Chaplin called sinners to repent, he waved his hand over the crowd and people nearly lost their minds. Elderly women fell backward. Men started shouting and hollering. One woman claimed she'd been healed of gallstones. Another woman told the news reporters that a goiter had gone down in size by 3 inches. Jay Wilbur Chaplin preached for 91 minutes, fully clothed. One newspaper headline read, "Revival Hits Alabama." Chapter 94, Through the Static. Ruth read the Friday morning edition of the newspaper in earnest. She was not normally a newspaper reader, but the image on the front page had caught her attention. It looked like hundreds of people, hands raised, surrounding a man standing atop a car. She leaned against the counter of the kitchenette and waited for the dollop of grease to get soft in the skillet. She adjusted the knob on the stove so the flame swelled. She felt like a grown-up, cooking and making breakfast. She felt even older when she gave the newspaper one swift shake to straighten it. She did it again just because it made her feel so mature. She studied the photo with great care. She adjusted the hot skillet over the flame, then read about the most famous evangelist in America, a man she'd only ever known by name. The paper said several hundred people had spontaneously had a revival as he preached a sermon while standing on the roof of a car. She remembered Vern listening to this preacher on the truck radio every Wednesday night during her youth, sometimes seated in the truck cab by himself, staring through the windshield. When she came to the part about the woman people called the harlot, she paused and felt a shiver run through her. She remembered overhearing people talk about this. "Pete, do you believe people can come back from the dead?" Pete was wearing a white undershirt, shaving his face in the mirror. "What are you talking about?" The grease in the skillet began to crackle. "You know, like a miracle." "I don't know. Why?" The crackling sound of a skillet awakened the motel room and caused Stringbean to sit before Marigold's feet with a look of importance on her face. Ruth ignored the hungry animal and kept reading the paper to herself. Stringbean licked her jowls and positioned herself a few inches closer to the skillet. Her body was still. Her eyes were enormous. She touched her nose against Ruth's hand, just to remind her that she was alive and hadn't eaten in over 8 hours. Ruth patted Stringbean's head without turning from the newspaper. When the eggs were done frying, they sat at the small table. She loved this motel. She loved everything about it. She loved the mermaids on the wall. She loved the ceiling fan and the two-burner stove. The hot showers gave her life purpose. She felt something swell in her chest. She didn't know what this feeling was, but it was good. Pete wasted no time digging into his food, but something about this felt wrong. "Wait, Pete," she said. He stopped eating. He wore a bewildered look. Grease slid down his chin. Stringbean also looked at her with a grave face. "Ain't you going to say grace?" "Grace? Over breakfast? Don't you think we should start praying and saying grace now that we're married?" "Grace." She folded her hands. Pete placed his fork on his plate and wiped his hands. He folded them together and cleared his throat. "What do I say?"
"I don't know. Just say something graceful.
Pray that you can find a job today. Okay. But he couldn't seem to find the words. She interjected.
Thanks for everything. We feel really happy about the way things are going lately. Keep up the good work.
She opened her eyes to see that Pete's eyes were still shut tightly.
Pete, you have anything you'd like to add?
God, it's me, Pete. Give my best to Mama and Paul and Louisville. Silence followed. Only the sound of String Bean's stomach gurgling could be heard. Finally, Pete said, Are we supposed to say amen or something?
I don't think it really matters.
They unfolded their hands and started eating, and Ruth felt good inside, though she couldn't describe why. Maybe it was the words they'd said over their food that had done it to her. She looked at the newspaper there on the table.
Pete, I want to go to a revival tonight.
Do what? He said.
Revival.
What's that?
I don't know, but I want to go.
Chapter 95 Glory. The large sign by the road read Holy Ghost Revival in large red letters. The word revival was written bigger than the other words and had dripped. Cars were parking in the scalped field, forming a gulf of automobiles that blanketed the earth. The crowd was bigger than anything Coot had ever seen, and he'd seen giant audiences in his day. Once, a crowd in Iola, Kansas had been so big they had to tear down the tent because it wouldn't hold them. This was much bigger. Much, much bigger. In the center of the ocean of automobiles was a large pine structure the size of a baseball stadium. It was a tent made of wood. J. Wilbur had explained that this was only a temporary arena to house the revival and stand against the weather. It had been built especially for this weekend, and it would be torn down when the revival services were finished. The wood would be donated and reused by the needy. The large columns would be recycled into telephone poles, and the crossbeams would be used for public buildings. The building itself was a marvel. The tall support beams inside were towers, and the rafters were made from hewn logs that must have required a crane to lift them. Coot bent his neck backwards, staring at it. He whistled. The vehicles in the parking lot kept multiplying. Men in overalls and crumpled hats crawled out of them, accompanied by poor-looking families. Women holding children. Kids, skinny and quiet, dressed in faded clothes. And there were wealthy families, too, dressed in light colors. Migrant workers riding in the backs of large trucks. Foreigners speaking in another language, with tanned skin and dark hair. Entire church buses filled with men in suits. Everyone found seats on the long wood benches beneath the pine canopy, hats in hands, heads held low, faces drawn in reverence. Revival. A woman played the piano. A brass band took the stage and joined the woman. People stood from their benches and sang. Their voices were so loud, Coot could feel the vibrations in his ribs, even from outside the building. Marigold was seated on a bench beside him. Behind the large building, just beneath an oak tree, he kissed her. She kissed him back. Coot could see she was trembling. Her eyes were staring at all the cars that stretched toward the horizon. He held her against him and took in the scent of her hair, like lavender. She took his hand and held it. He was lost in the rapture of her. She was the kind of person he'd always wished he could be. He could tell it by the way she talked. There was a sincerity in her that he did not have, a kind of heart that believed in more things than he did. When she leaned against him, it felt as though he had found salvation.
I'm nervous.
Oh, don't be. He patted her knee.
Thank you for being with me. Thank you for doing what you did.
I'm not going anywhere. This seemed to satisfy her.
I never wanted to be what I am. I never wanted any of this to happen. I don't feel like I belong here.
Oh, you're the only one who does belong here. He felt the familiar pre-show jitters of his youth, and he felt the thrill of performance upon him. It was all coming back to him, and it made his heart so sore. He said, you know, for years I hated this.
Hated what?
This. He waved his hand at everything.
All my life, I hated every bit of this and the cheats who were behind it. What do you mean? Well, I grew up around these people. There are a lot of dishonest men in this bunch, a lot of cheats, a lot of cutthroats and liars. He laughed softly and stared at his shoes. But they ain't all like that. She kissed him again. They'd been doing a lot of that. And they both drew strength from those kisses. When you touched Joseph, he said, you did something to me, too. I didn't do nothing. No, you did. And I know what you're here for. You're here to do what you did to Joseph and what you done to me. You're here to revive people. Chapter 96, Ruth Shall Set You Free. The line of vehicles was a few miles long, stretching past the city limits. Ruth and Pete waited in a line of traffic until people began parking their vehicles in ditches and on hillsides, and some left them right in the center of the road. Pete parked in the ditch until his door was almost touching the earth, and Ruth's door was high in the air. He crawled out Ruth's side and walked the dirt road where other people were heading, String Bean followed behind. They reached the white sign that read Holy Ghost Revival, and Pete whistled when he saw the large wood structure in the distance. "Have you ever seen so many cars in your life?" he said.
"No."
She didn't say anything else because she didn't know what to say. The truth was, it did seem rather bizarre. The people they passed on the road all seemed strange. The looks they gave her were not like the kinds of normal looks you get in daily life. It was as though everyone suspected something magnificent was going to happen. When they neared the wood structure, she could hear the sounds of a tuba and other brass instruments, and a bass drum and a snare, and singing. Lots of singing. There were so many voices she could swear she felt the earth moving. String Bean looked almost frightened when she heard it. She stayed near Pete. The closer Ruth got, the more her vision was blocked by other people. Ruth leapt up to get a better view over the sea of heads and hats. She jumped a few times but couldn't see where to go. The wood structure was surrounded by people like chickens gathered around a June bug. "We're not going to be able to get inside," Pete said. "There must be 2,000 people here. We might as well turn around and leave." She was not about to leave. She felt something in this place.
"You wait here, Pete. I just want to go see what I can see." "Ruth, just wait here. I promise I'll be back."
"Wait," he said, chasing after her, but she had already left him in the dust. Hordes of people surrounded the building on all sides. They were peeking into the gaps between the wood, and children were sitting on the shoulders of grown men. The crowd pulsated with brassy music. The closer she got, the louder the music became. People were standing outside singing along with the people inside, and it sounded like voices were either rising to heaven or coming from it. Ruth didn't know the words to the song, but the people around her did. She closed her eyes and let the sounds of the voices swirl around her. When the singing finished, there was applause from inside the wooden building loud enough to blow the nearby trees out of the dirt. Then, people outside the wood tent began to murmur among themselves. Eventually, one man standing in front of Ruth, who wore a white hat and a blue suit, turned to her and said, "The harlot's on stage now." The news spread throughout the crowd like wildfire. People spoke of the harlot with true wonder. Ruth could hear it in their voices. The man beside Ruth was leaning on a crutch.
"It's her! It's her!"
he said. He started pushing his way through the crowd, leaning on the flimsy stick beneath him. He was a big man dressed in overalls. He could hardly move on his game leg. He tried to weave through the tight-knit group of onlookers. People were not gracious to him. One man pushed the disabled man, who then fell onto his hind parts, and people ignored the fallen man, writhing on the ground. Ruth rushed to him before he was trampled to death. She helped him to his feet, and she could hear him grunting in pain. He leaned on to her for support and said,
"Thank you. There's too many people here. We're never going to get through," she told him.
He was panting from exhaustion, and he started to weep. It was as though this realization was finally beginning to land on him. She held him, this stranger. She could smell his sweat when he cried into her shoulder.
"Shh," she said. "I gotta try. I just gotta."
She shook her head.
"There's nothing we can do. I want to get through as bad as you do." "Oh, please help me, miss. Please help me try."
Something came over her.
a kind of determination she couldn't explain where it came from. Before she knew it, Ruth was nudging people from her path. The man was holding her for balance, doing his best to keep her pace. Ruth shoved people aside and offered excuse me's when she passed them. They weaved through the clots of onlookers, saying, "Pardon us! Excuse us! Coming through!" She was met with ugly stares from those who refused to let her by. But she worked through the maze of people a few inches at a time, using force when needed. They finally stopped for a rest. She was out of breath, and her legs hurt from supporting the weight of the big man who held her.
"We're never going to make it. This is pointless. We're no closer than when we started."
At first, he couldn't answer. He was breathing so heavily.
"Please, please. I come all the way from Greenville to see that lady healer. You really believe she can heal you? Oh, if I could just touch her."
"And what? You think that would heal you?"
"If I can just touch her."
They worked their way toward the building. Ruth was unsure if she was getting closer to the entrance or farther away until she saw clumps of children seated next to the wood walls with noses pressed into the gaps between the planks. Ruth wedged between the children, working herself near the entrance. The man lost his grip on her and fell straight on his face. She helped him off the dust and saw that his nose was bleeding.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine. Keep moving. We're getting closer."
"But you're bleeding."
"I'm fine."
She could hear people cuss them when they pushed past. She ignored them and kept moving. She clawed her way through the group of people until she finally neared the door. And she saw her. A woman. The woman stood only feet before her. She had brilliant red hair. And she was tall and lovely. Ruth found herself unable to move. The woman looked at Ruth. She wanted to step forward, but her legs were stuck. The man released Ruth's arm and hobbled to the woman with a labored gait. He limped so badly he could hardly remain upright. When he was finally before the woman, he doubled over to catch his breath. The woman looked at the man and said,
"What's your name, sir?"
He was too busy breathing. The woman looked at Ruth.
"Are you his daughter?"
"No, ma'am,"
said Ruth. The woman knelt low. She touched the man's leg.
"Is this the one? Is this the one?"
He nodded. He cried. The woman took a deep breath and rolled up his trousers, exposing his skinny leg, deformed and scarred. The woman pressed both hands against the man's leg. His breathing slowed. Ruth expected to see something miraculous, but she saw nothing. His leg did not change. There were no lights from heaven. But his posture became strong, and he stood upright. He stood on his own feet, and it took a few steps with ease, as though he'd never had a problem in his life. The woman moved her eyes back to Ruth.
"You're a good friend."
"No, ma'am,"
said Ruth.
"I don't know him."
"What's your name?"
said the woman.
"Ruth."
"Ruth,"
the woman said.
"You have such pretty hair, sweetheart."
The woman reached her hand to touch the girl's hair. Something happened. Something Ruth felt inside her temples. An unfamiliar feeling. And gentle. Not overwhelming, but soft. It worked its way across her head and through her eyes and down into her belly. It was a warm feeling, like being dipped into a hot pond on a July afternoon. The woman must have felt it, too, because she looked at Ruth with large eyes and an open mouth. The woman pulled back from Ruth and placed a hand over her mouth. And in that moment, the sounds of the congregation faded into nothing. The people around Ruth disappeared. All she could see was the woman's outline, and all she could feel was the woman's presence. It was unmistakable, the feeling inside her. It was a familiar feeling located within the recesses of her person. Ruth felt the dam inside her burst.
"Mama,"
she said. Chapter 97. Sewn Together. In her dream, Marigold was a child. She was lying on her back in the creek, her face aimed at the sky. She was watching the clouds move upon themselves. They were slow, and the sky was powder blue.
The groves of grass and monstrous pines loomed overhead, but she couldn't see them. Only sky. It was always there. Bigger than everything that lives in the world. She felt something in her hand. She turned to see a man lying beside her in the water. He was wearing a white linen suit that was ruined with creek mud. He was young, handsome, and it occurred to her that he was holding her hand. This young man. This man in linen. She turned her head to the other side. She saw a little girl also lying beside her. The girl had a mane of copper that had turned dark with the flowing spring water. The girl stared at the sky with her eyes wide open. The girl grinned and met Marigold's eyes.
"Did you worry about me?" said the girl. "I worried about you every second of the day," said Marigold.
Then Marigold was yanked from her dream and found herself in a bed in a dark room. The walls were covered with mermaid wallpaper. Her child, Maggie, was beside her, an adult woman. Earlier that night, they had talked and cried until they'd fallen asleep here. They had shed enough tears to make a creek of their own. Marigold had tried to fit 100 years into a few hours of conversation, and each word she offered had felt weak somehow, pathetic even. Her words had seemed like silly attempts to explain something that was big, universal, something that was larger than words. She tried to describe the depths of pain she felt and the heights of anguish, but none of her words did justice. She feared Maggie would never know her the way she wanted her to. What Marigold really wanted was to sew their hearts together with thread and needle so that Maggie knew everything, knew how scared she'd been, and how her entire life had been sadness without her daughter, and how she never stopped thinking about her, and how every ticking second on the clock was peppered with thoughts of Maggie. But hearts can't be sewn together. They will always be separated by flesh and bone and distance, and weak words are all anyone can use. Marigold crawled out of bed. She stepped over Coot, the young man who was married to her daughter, and the large dog who slept on the floor between them. The men were covered with flannel blankets, fast asleep on the floorboards. The dog was snoring. Marigold walked outside beneath the night sky. From the breezeway of the motor inn, she could see the Mobile Bay, calm as bathwater.
"Evening," said Joseph. "Going for a walk?"
"Yeah. You want to come?"
"No, thanks, but you be careful."
"I will."
She wandered toward the bay, down the craggy hill that led to a sandy shore. She touched her foot into the cold water. She stared up at the sky. She looked at the moon. It had been her friend for a long time. For most of her life, it had represented the only friend she had. But now it was not needed. All her life, she'd wanted to be known. That's all anyone wanted, she thought, to be known. She wanted someone to worry about her. She wanted the gift of knowing that somebody concerned themselves with thoughts of her, the way she worried for others. Yes, that's what she'd always wanted. She wanted someone to lose sleep thinking about her. She wanted someone to care enough about her to feel the same worry she felt for Maggie. But here on the sand beside the bay, she realized she had indeed always been known and worried about. She could feel it from the sky. She could feel it from the earth.
"I don't understand," she said in a soft voice. "And I don't want to anymore. But I just want to thank you. Thank you."
She hoped for something to happen when she said it. She hoped for the sound of a bird, or the splash of a wave, or a gust of wind. Anything would have been welcome. But that isn't the way life works. She knelt on the sand. She folded her hands. She pressed them against her face.
"Thank you," she said again.
She heard the sound of footsteps behind her. She turned to see Coot standing at a distance.
"I was getting worried about you," he said.
Chapter 98. Cold Hands. A healer. That's what people were calling her. They'd come from as far away as Atlanta to see her, the woman from the whorehouse, to have her pray for them.
The crowd was even bigger than before. The wood structure wouldn't begin to hold them all. News of the healings had spread far and wide. Newspapermen were in attendance. There were men cranking movie cameras, standing on tall ladders, perched on the edges of the field. The governor had shown up. There were sick people, and families, and children, and old people. People gathered together and waited for the harlot to touch them. It was terrifying and inspiring and humbling, and she touched them all. But something was very different today. Marigold touched a woman who claimed she had a blind left eye, but Marigold felt nothing in her hands. She felt no heat, no jolt, no nothing. The woman cried and blinked her eyes, claimed she felt different, but Marigold knew nothing had happened. And even though the woman rejoiced, Marigold knew the woman still had a blind eye when she left. A lady with rheumatism came to Marigold next. She touched the woman on the shoulders. The woman tried to stand upright. She smiled and cried beneath the pain. But Marigold knew nothing had changed inside the woman. Marigold felt no buzzing in her head, no vibration in her hands, no heat in her palms. A man with bad hearing followed the lady. Marigold touched the man's ears. The man claimed he could hear out of his ear once again, but Marigold knew it wasn't true. There were no healings, no miracles. There were only people who wanted to be whole, people who wanted someone to understand them. It was over. She knew she was not the woman she'd been the day before. She knew something in her had shifted. Something in the sky had shifted. The sun set like it always did that night, and the stars came out to play. The large crowds of people left, one vehicle at a time, and after a few hours, the entire place was nothing but a peanut field again. "What's wrong?" Coot finally asked. She looked at his kind eyes and said, "For once in my life, nothing." Chapter 99. Tearing Things Down. The world came alive with the insect sounds of early evening. The sky was smeared with the colors of sunset, and men labored beneath it, deconstructing the wood stadium. It had taken 2 days to tear down the structure. Coot enjoyed the sweat and task of loading large planks of wood into a truck with Pete and Joseph, too. Coot couldn't believe he was seeing the old man moving his limbs beneath the load of work, sweating. Joseph worked beside Coot, wearing a sweat-stained white T-shirt and work gloves on his hands. They hurled the wood planks like spears. "How are you doing?" Coot asked Joseph.
"What do you mean, how am I doing? I got raised from the dead, that's how I'm doing. How are you doing is a better question."
"I'm doing fine."
"Well, I'm doing better than you."
Joseph lifted a large plank of wood and shot it toward the truck with the strength of a teenager. The old man's short-sleeved shirt revealed a skinny arm, loose-skinned but muscled. One of the workmen whistled, then shouted,
"Supper's here!"
Coot stood straight to see a chain of automobiles winding through the empty dirt prairie. One car followed another. The cars stopped, and women wearing cotton dresses emerged from them. They were all carrying casserole tins and covered dishes and baskets.
"The food wagon. Thank God I was about to starve," said Joseph.
"What are you talking about? You ain't done nothing but eat jerky and crackers all day." Coot saw Marigold walking toward him. She carried a basket under one arm, her daughter walking close beside her beneath the other. Tailing them was a dog with very long ears and a big appetite. The two women had heads of hair that were the same shade in the setting sunlight, like fire. Marigold was watching Coot, too. She stopped, and their eyes locked on one another. Coot lifted his arm to wave at her. She waved back at him. She came near to him and wrapped her arms around his waist. He kissed her, and she kissed him back. He felt the closeness of her, and it was almost too much to bear. It was so rewarding, it was almost dreamlike.
"I take that back," said Joseph. "You're doing better than I am."
Chapter 100. Hollering.
Rabbit Creek forked from the bay water and meandered through the thicket of cypress trees that poked from the water like little men bearing the weight of their limbs. The longleaf pines looked purple in the distance. The live oaks were towering high, snaking their branches over the surface of the water. There was noise in the distance. Marigold listened to Stringbean howl. The dog let out low, happy howls. She smiled at the dog. The animal's black and tan fur dripped with bay water, then turned her hair into a curly mess. The animal had been swimming in the water all morning. Marigold had never had so much fun watching an animal play without holding back. She'd been tossing sticks for the dog to chase and felt sorry that she'd gone almost an entire life without knowing the simple pleasures of a dog. Ruth was beside her. Ruth hollered at the dog, and her voice cut through the air like a mother's voice.
"Get over here, Bean," said Ruth, patting her thighs. "Come on, girl, come on, girl."
Her shouts bounced off the bay water and were met with the sound of dog's paws clomping on the earth in a dead sprint. Marigold watched the animal gallop toward home, and it was stunning to see the muscles of the animal flexed in the full sunlight. The dog neared them and shook her coat, water flung in all directions like a sideways thunderstorm. She felt something stir inside her. How she felt when she watched the storms that used to flood the creek behind Kowicki's. The rains would fill the creek so high that the brown water would become level with the earth, and it was almost impossible to tell where the creek began and the earth ended. It always made her feel good to see so much rain falling at once. It made her grateful. It was a gift from the heavens to the earth, a simple gift. That's how she felt now. She felt like she'd been given a drink of water that filled her from the inside. Earlier that day, Helen and the girls had come to visit. They had brought cold salads and baskets of blueberries and flowers. They'd spent the entire afternoon telling Ruth stories about Marigold's youth. They talked so much that Marigold was sure Ruth's head was going to split open. Before Helen left, with Abe's hand in hers, she held Marigold for so long that they almost forgot they were holding each other. No words were spoken because none were needed. That evening, Marigold went for a long walk with Ruth through the thick forest. She asked Ruth, "Would it be okay if I held your hand, sweetie?" And Ruth stretched out her hand. They touched. The girl's hand was warm, and Marigold's was not. They walked the shore of the bay until the no-see-ums and the mosquitoes had destroyed their arms and legs. They picked a few wildflowers, and Marigold felt the warmth that was once in her hands move into her chest instead. Ruth asked, "Why did you name me Maggie?" Marigold told her the story and sang the lyrics of the song and did her best not to cry. It was so odd to be singing it to this girl she knew but didn't know. She was not Ruth, not to Marigold. But then, she was not her Maggie either, but someone infinitely more beautiful and striking than Maggie could ever be. This was a woman. A woman who was her own person, strong, brave, and kind. Ruth pulled Marigold into herself.
"You know, I always thought of you and wondered what you'd be like."
Marigold lost herself in their embrace.
"I thought of you every second of every day."
They pressed themselves together and rested their foreheads against one another. Their red hair became mingled, and their hearts were as close as they'd ever been without being sewn together. Marigold could feel Maggie. And within the strange manner that the universe works, she knew Maggie had become the person she was intended to be.
"I'm sorry," said Marigold,
for it was all she could think to say, and it was something she'd been wanting to say for a very long time. Anything else would have sounded wrong. Anything else would have been too much. Ruth smiled.
"Quit your sorrying," she said.
You've been listening to the audio production of Stars of Alabama, text copyright 2019 by Sean Dietrich, production copyright 2019 by Thomas Nelson. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other books and audio products from Thomas Nelson, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. Stars of Alabama was recorded at Kingswood Studios by Nashville Audio Productions.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.